Certainly wish to extend Christian greetings again. It's a privilege to be gathered in worship again here with the saints. What an inspiration it is to look into the book of Ruth, also to think about David and the Psalms and all that we've considered in the songs that we've sung, and so much inspiration for us this morning. We have been examining a number of different heart issues this week, and I want to look at another one I haven't talked a whole lot about yet. I was reading an account recently about Tommy and Virginia Stevens of Nashville, Tennessee. They had been married for 69 years, and they died just a few days apart. The part of that news article that stood out to me was that toward the end of their lives, Tommy was suffering from Alzheimer's disease and from pneumonia and from sepsis. He was in the hospital. And his wife, Virginia, had fallen. And she had broken six ribs and her spine and her hip. But she wanted to see her husband, so they managed to get her into the hospital room where he was. And when they brought them into the same hospital room, the aides testified that they both visibly lit up, and they didn't want to stop holding hands the whole time that they were together. And I thought, well, what a testament to a lasting love relationship. This morning, the title of my message is Love, Sweat, and Roses. You can turn with me to Colossians chapter 3 this morning. We're going to base our thoughts in these admonitions from the Apostle Paul. It's always fascinating to me how Apostle Paul builds his instruction, and we'll look a little bit at that. We can't look at the whole book, but we'll look a little bit at that as he crafts his directives to us and builds us up to understand what he wants us to learn. Colossians chapter 3. As many of you know, I didn't marry until pretty late in life. I was almost 45 years old. Now I've only been married for a little over 45 months, and you might say, well, you don't have enough experience to talk about love or marriage. Well, you're probably right. I know we have people here who've already had their 50th wedding anniversary, but I still think this is an important subject to talk about, and I think that I at least recognize some things that I know I was wrong about, so perhaps I can share that, and as we reflect on these things, we can all learn some things. Now, it would seem as if my message this morning was focused solely on married couples, but it's not. This message also applies to single people. It also applies to dating couples. It also applies to people who are trying to build relationships of any kind. And it's sort of in that context that we see Paul beginning here. We want to start our reading at verse 12 and read through verse 19, but I would like if everyone could stand during this reading and you could read together with me. So please stand to your feet, Colossians chapter 3, and join me together reading verses 12 to 19. Put on, therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, bowels of mercies, kindness, humbleness of mind, meekness, long-suffering, forbearing one another, and forgiving one another. If any man have a quarrel against any, even as Christ forgave you, so also do ye. And above all these things put on charity, which is the bond of perfectness. And let the peace of God rule in your hearts, to the which also ye are called in one body, and be ye thankful. Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing with grace in your hearts to the Lord. And whatsoever ye do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God and the Father by him. Wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as it is fit in the Lord.
Husbands, love your wives, and be not bitter against them.
Thank you for sharing that. You may be seated. And there's so many, many things we could preach about as we just look at this, these few verses. There's so much instruction here for us, and each one of these words can be unfolded into a depth of understanding. And I think a little bit here about his call to understand the peace of God. And I was recently impressed in verse 16 how Paul tells us what we should tell ourselves. If you need instruction, you can sing to yourself psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, and it will build you up in the Lord. So a lot of good admonition here. And it's fascinating to me that Paul starts talking about where our hearts are and where our connection to God is and where our emotions are. And then he finally builds up to human relationships, as we see him beginning to introduce that in verse 18. And he goes on down through the rest of the chapter and into the next one. But we want to focus our attention on love. And so we'll talk a little bit about that as we look at this passage. Now, in our world today, romantic love, as it were, is often portrayed sort of as the pinnacle of fulfillment or the pinnacle of satisfaction, but that's not what we see painted here in this passage, I would say. And it's interesting to see that when Paul starts talking about marriage, and he talks about wives, and he starts talking about husbands, that just prior to that, he's talking about things like mercy and long-suffering and forgiveness, and he's even addressing things like quarrels, and then he talks about submission, and then he talks about avoiding bitterness. And after a while, you're reading down through this passage, and you think to yourself, Paul, do you have any idea what love is? Paul, do you understand how marriage works? Do you know how love is supposed to work in a relationship? What's going on here? Well, I think that's our problem, not Paul's problem, and I think we're going to see that this morning. I've entitled my first point this morning, The Appeal of Love. In 1992, I was 15, and my family was not doing very well. It wasn't the brightest years of their lives. Just a couple of years earlier, my mother had been diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. Her health was steadily declining. It was putting a strain on the family. She was no longer able to do a lot of what she had been able to do in the past. And it was putting a strain on the children, but was also putting a strain on my father. My older siblings were in their older teenage years, and there was some friction there and some challenges as they were trying to find their way. My older brothers were struggling to find connection in the local community, and they were sort of experimenting with worldliness and with listening to the radio and with magazines and things that were clearly worldly. And my dad, whose own parents had divorced when he was young, was just struggling to cope with all of this and the challenges of raising teenagers and the fact that his wife was sick and everything that was going on. And the upshot of it was that there was a lot of tension in our home. There was a lot of destructive behaviors. There was a lot of anger. There was a lot of bitterness. And so me as a 15-year-old, I remember sitting in church one Sunday, and there was a visiting preacher there, and he preached this sermon on marriage. And I was sitting there, and I was taking notes in my notebook. And I remember one of the brothers said to me after church, he said, well, you took a lot of notes on that. You're pretty young yet to be taking notes on that message, but I guess it's good to be thinking good thoughts about marriage. But to me, it was serious at the moment because I said to myself, I do not want to repeat the mistakes that I see my parents making in my home. And I think that was probably a worthy sentiment. God does show us mistakes so that we can learn things from them. But eventually, at some point in my mind, I began to think that the answer to the chaos of life and the problems and the stresses and the challenges I had in dealing with it and the personal pain I was carrying was to find a perfect wife and to start a home where everything would be good. It was a very appealing thought. And I thought, well, it certainly would be a good gift, and so God would certainly want to give it to me. And so I began praying regularly, daily, that God would lead me to a godly wife and that I could establish a godly home. But God did not grant that request. And I thought at the time was that God was just not listening very well. But I actually learned that God had a number of things he needed to teach me before I was ready to take that step. And one of the things I needed to learn is this difference between true love, as is outlined in Scripture, and romantic love, as is outlined in worldly philosophy that we're surrounded with and in some ways immersed in today. And so one of the points about romantic love that I needed to come to grips with is that romantic love is not the answer to life's problems. If our family is dysfunctional and falling apart, romantic love is not the answer. And if I find myself feeling lonely and depressed, romantic love is not the answer. And if I struggle to make friends or to keep friends, romantic love is not the answer. If I feel misunderstood, if I feel underappreciated, if I feel in need of people recognizing my worth, romantic love is not the answer. And if I struggle with sexual temptation, romantic love is not the answer. And it's something I need to emphasize this morning because it's something that we can so easily embrace, a falsehood we can so easily embrace given to us not by God, by the world around us. It's important for us to note, and I think this is going to sound a little ridiculous, but I think that's the point. It's important to note that when Nicodemus came to Jesus by night, he didn't say, "Aren't you married?" And when Peter came to the crowd at Pentecost, he didn't say, "Get married." And the Ethiopian didn't say to Philip, "Well, why has God prevented me from getting married?" That wasn't the point. That wasn't the focus. That wasn't the goal. There were far more important things than that. Now, love is a wonderful thing, and as we understand it in its depth and in its breadth, and as God demonstrates it to us, it will change our lives. But that's a different picture than what is so often painted by the world, and it's interesting, it is important for us to note that true love is founded in love for God, and we see that in those familiar words from Deuteronomy chapter 6 and verse 5, where God says, "And thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thine heart and with all thy soul and with all thy might." And that's really what Paul echoes in Colossians. And if we would go back to the beginning of chapter 3 here in the context of what we were just reading, you'll see that he begins the chapter with these words, "If ye then be risen with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ sitteth on the right hand of God. Set your affection..." You want to think of that as your love and your commitment. "Set your affection on things above, not on things on the earth. For ye are dead, and your life is hid with Christ in God. When Christ, who is our life, shall appear, then shall ye also appear with him in glory." And so it's very important for us to understand, and this is my second subpoint here, that our fulfillment and our well-being flow out of our relationship with God. You hear what Paul says? He says, "Seek those things which are above." He says, "Set your affection on things above." He says, "Christ is our life." And we need to get that point. It's very essential. If we want a wonderful peace, if we want a happiness that's unshaken, if we want a perfect life, if you will, then our life must be grounded and rooted in God, and our love must be devoted to God. If you truly know God and his love and are surrendered to his will in your life and you're not looking out for your own interests but pursuing what he wants, then our marital state doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether we're married or whether we're dating or whether we're single. Our life can be rich and it can be full and it can be blessed as we walk with God. But if I am confused about whether God loves me or not, if I'm hesitant to surrender to him, and if I spend a lot of time looking out for my own interests and my own security, then it doesn't matter either. It doesn't matter whether I'm dating or whether I'm married or whether I'm single. I will be a miserable person and my life will be a wreck, because the essential point is that our heart is dedicated and to and grounded in God. And that brings me to my third subpoint here, and that is true love is a product of our love for God. So sacrificial love and brotherly love and true romantic love, all of these find their richness and their fullness and their fulfillment out of the foundation of our love for God. And so if I have a friendship and that friendship seems meaningful to me, but it takes me away from Christian service and it takes me away from responsible living and it takes me away from interest in serving God, then that relationship will end up being hollow and empty. I won't find in it what I'm truly looking for. And if I'm dating and my boyfriend or my girlfriend is causing me to be less interested in studying the Bible and less interested in prayer and less interested in church attendance, then I know that love's going to let me down cruelly. That's not based on the important core of love for God. But if I love God with all my heart and with all my soul and with all my mind and with all my strength, and then my friendships flow out of that, then there is no more wonderful thing than learning to understand and reflect the love of God in the lives of our fellow people. And you'll notice that throughout Scripture, from beginning to end, there is this very fascinating correlation between love for God and love for our fellow men. And they always go hand in hand. So we can have a flip side, which is we're not going to really look at this morning, but we can have a flip side in which a person can say, I love God, and I'm dedicated to Him, and I enjoy worshiping Him. I just can't get along with anyone. Well, that's another reflection that our love for God isn't really what it should be. But we're looking at sort of the other side, which is if we are grounded in our love for God and we do understand Him in the sense of His calling on our lives and we surrender and we follow, then it affects our human relationships and our human relationships are blessed by that founding in God. Our hearts can be full and we can experience blessing in a way that we never really imagined if we dedicate ourselves to God. Now, in my own experience, the first time I dated, I made some very foolish mistakes. In the first place, I dated because I thought, well, that's what everyone does. And it seems like a good thing, and it seems like a very reasonable thing to do. But it was not primarily because I was convinced that this particular call was the call of God on my life. Another mistake I made was that I desperately tried to keep my best foot forward. I thought, well, this is the way good relationships are built, is if I only show my girlfriend the best side of me. Because, I mean, why would I want to expose my flaws and my weaknesses? Well, because I made those mistakes and some others beside, that relationship ended in pain and heartbreak. It didn't work out. And I look back on that and I say, well, that was actually a gift of God, that He was showing me what's important and what is not important. But in 2021, when my wife Faith and I started dating, both of us had fully decided ahead of time that we would only date if we were completely convinced that this was God's will for us. And we also started our relationship by both being committed to being completely transparent about our faults and our shortcomings. And that, of course, introduced some challenges into our relationship. But it also allowed us to build a relationship that was authentic and that was built on a sense of trust and a sense of confidence that we could not otherwise have enjoyed. And I think we can both testify that we found blessing in following God's path. And when I contrast that with thinking about one of my brothers, he pursued marriage, and I don't think his intent was to bypass the will of God, but he was very spiritually immature, and so was his girlfriend. And neither of them sought the approval of their families. They weren't getting along well with their families, nor did they have a church. And they finally ended up slipping away and getting married on their own by a justice of the peace. And they really both did try very hard to make their marriage work. They did. But I still recall the anguish in my brother's voice when he called me one day and told me that his wife had filed for divorce. And I would say that every single day since that time, and it's been years now, there have been painful reminders of that broken relationship. And it's a solemn warning to us that our relationships cannot be blessed if they are not built on a love for God. And I'm not saying that relationships that were started on a bad foundation cannot be redeemed as we surrender our hearts to God, but it all comes back to being surrendered to God and his work and desire in our lives. Now, our second point this morning is the necessity of sweat. And that's what I see as I look at these surrounding verses in this passage in Colossians chapter 3. Because it's interesting, Paul doesn't start this section or even these last couple of verses that we read where he talks about husbands and wives. He doesn't say, just kick back and enjoy it. Romantic love is a wonderful thing. That's not really the context in which he talks. He leads up to this by saying things like, put on mercy, kindness, humility, meekness, long-suffering. And we have to ask ourselves the question, as young people or as married partners or as girlfriends and boyfriends, we have to ask ourselves the question, what is my expectation? What is my goal? What kind of experience do I think dating and marriage should look like? And I can assure you that if your expectation, goal, and focus is not mercy or kindness or humility or meekness or long-suffering, your hopes and dreams are not going to come true. Because we have to recognize, this is my first sub-point, and point two, love requires sacrifice. Love requires sacrifice. For love to grow, sacrifice must be an integral part of it. And I don't know if you've ever had a family member who broke down on the highway somewhere and they didn't really have anyone else to reach out to, so they called you up and said, hey, I broke down on the highway and I'm not sure what to do. Can you please come help? And so you got up out of your easy chair and you got in the vehicle and maybe it was dark and maybe even rainy and you drove down there and you found yourself in the mud on your knees trying to hook up a vehicle for pulling onto a trailer or change a tire or something like that. And you did not think, now that's love. But it is, isn't it? Because they knew they could reach out to you because they knew there was some sense of connection there. And that's a tiny, tiny example, really, of what God demonstrated to us in Jesus, who had a heavenly throne and could certainly have reached down in some ways and helped us, but he was willing to come all the way down and live among men and die on our behalf so that we could really understand that God loves us. And in that way, the cross is a giant symbol that love is sacrifice. And we see that. And in a parallel passage on marriage, as Paul writes in Ephesians chapter 5, it's interesting to me that he says this. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 25, he says, husbands, love your wives. Okay, we expected that. Even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it. And I think if we could somehow grasp that, that would completely transform our marriage relationships. Because the picture here is a sacrificial, dedicated love. Love your wife like Christ loved the church. Sacrifice for your wife like Christ sacrificed for the church. This should be our motto if we want our marriage to succeed. Now, it's interesting also, Paul speaks to the women in Ephesians chapter 5, 2, and he says, wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as unto the Lord. Wives, give your husbands honor, give your husbands respect, give your husbands encouragement, even if you're better at doing it than they are. This is the call, and this doesn't sound like the love that the world advertises. But we also look at the world and see that the world is filled with broken relationships and scarred people. And so as Christians, understanding this picture that love is sacrifice and requires sacrifice and is lived out through sacrifice, just like Jesus, is very and very important. Jesus didn't come as a slaveholder. He didn't come as a nag. He didn't come as a gossip. He didn't come complaining. He didn't come arguing and manipulating. He didn't come for himself. He came for us. He came in obedience. He came in service. He came in humility. He came in sacrifice. And that is how he demonstrated love. And if we struggle to think if that could possibly outline marriage, then we don't really understand God's plan for marriage. We don't know what a good marriage looks like. And it's so, so easy for us to slide off of this picture. I remember a couple of years ago, I was coming home from a day of work, I don't remember exactly what I was doing, but it's just one of those things. I was driving toward the house, and I thought, oh, it's been a big day. There's been a lot going on. I just can't wait to get home. I'm sure my wife will have supper on the table, and it'll be a great time for me to relax. And so I pulled up to the house, and I stepped in the front door, and the kitchen dining room was empty, and there wasn't anything on the table, and there was no food prepared. And I was disappointed. I was perhaps felt let down, maybe even a little hurt. And as I reflected on it later, I thought, why? Why would I? Do I have some sort of right to have supper on the table the moment I step in the door? It actually wasn't even supper time yet. Does my wife have a sole responsibility to provide supper for me and not to do anything else? Well, of course not. As a matter of fact, she was busy. She was sewing. She was finishing up a dress for someone. And it was all perfectly fine. And as a matter of fact, I would have been capable of making supper if that's what was needed. So why the negative feelings? Well, it's because I had forgotten that love is sacrifice. And I had thought, subconsciously perhaps, that love is selfishness. But that's not true. It's not true. And when we allow things to get turned on their heads like that, then it ends up, first of all, in small ways, and then in bigger ways, destroying our relationships. Because love is not the world revolving around me. It's so easy for us to become selfish, and so easy for us to become entitled. And I thought about this a few months later, because sometimes in the morning, my wife sets the breakfast table, sometimes I set the breakfast table, but one couple mornings in a row, my wife had set the breakfast table, and she's a very thoughtful woman. She had everything laid out, and she had my plate and my bowl and my spoon, and she got my yogurt out and my jam, and it was all wonderful. And I sat down those couple of mornings, and I thought, oh, this is the life. I mean, it's all here, right? And then the next morning, she was busy helping some medical question or something. I don't remember exactly what, and not everything was on the table. And I sat down, and I thought, oh, not everything's on the table. And then I was reflecting on that, and I said, what is this? In two mornings, you're already stuck on this idea that you just sit back and let your wife do everything for you. There's no reason you can't get up and walk over to the fridge and grab something. How hard is that? It gets embarrassing when we start thinking about it, that just a couple of days of kind gestures and we begin to start feeling entitled. But that's not love, right? Because we have to understand that love is sacrifice. And it's not just that I need to do a couple of things to make sure I'm provided for. Sacrifice goes beyond that, right? Our desire is to serve others. That's what this is about. And for men, I think sometimes we get that whole leadership role upside down and backwards. And we think, well, since I'm the leader here, I can tell other people what they need to do. And if there's an issue to be resolved, I just say, okay, take care of that. Why aren't you doing that? But that's not leadership. That's not love. That's not sacrifice. If something's not working well, if something isn't happening, it's my responsibility to step up and to see that that issue is resolved or just to help in whatever way is required. I don't come to the trash can and say, oh, that's full. Tell my wife, empty that trash. I'm like, no, I can do this. It's right here. There's no reason I can't. This is my way to help. Let me step up and do something about it, you know? And so leadership is living and serving and sacrificing as Christ lived and served and sacrificed. That is key to laying this foundation for love in any relationship. Now, the second subpoint we can look at under this whole idea of investing in love or how love requires investment is that love requires forgiveness. And this is perhaps even a little harder than the idea that love requires sacrifice, because love does require forgiveness. And I feel like on some level, my wife and I were older when we were married. We were perhaps a bit more mature and planned ahead a little more. But that doesn't remove all the difficulties from life. I remember that we had these careful plans in place for when we were starting our married life. And we had planned that when we got back from the honeymoon, Faith's house there, the small house on Wilcox Road, we would settle in there and everything would be good. But when we got back, that's not how things worked out. I was struggling with my health, and there were some things that didn't seem to be working well for me. And so when we got back from our honeymoon, instead of settling into this cozy house on Wilcox Road, things kind of fell apart. And we ended up shifting and living in the master suite on 8 Mile Creek Road for a little while, which was a far less than ideal situation. And so I think to both of us, some plans had collapsed. But it was possibly a lot harder on my wife because she was all of a sudden in a strange environment and wasn't really sure how things were going. And it became quite a struggle for us and rather frustrating. And we became a little frustrated with each other and with the circumstances we were going through. And I thought, well, we just need to buckle down and take the next step. And I think my wife was thinking, we really need to talk through this. And so it was a bit of a challenge, and it can cause tensions and it can cause difficulties. It was one of the most challenging times that we faced. In these times, though, the temptation comes for us to gather and hold grudges. Tensions can rise. We can do things unadvisedly. And sometimes you see this so easily in small children. Maybe tensions are rising over a toy or an activity, and before you know it, one child has slapped at another, and then the other one slaps back, and then they're both mad, and it's an all-out brawl, and all of a sudden you're needing to stop and calm this whole situation. You would think adults would never act like that, but we can. Maybe just sometimes verbally, or maybe even sometimes silently, we can attempt to get back at each other for hurts that we perceive. And without really intending to, we can create scars that then mar our relationship and destroy the foundation of a secure and godly marriage. And the lesson for us is don't do it. Don't give in to that temptation. Don't sow those seeds. You don't want that harvest. Forgive. That's the call. Simply forgive. Love requires forgiveness. And Paul says in our text here in verses 13 and 14, forbearing one another. And that word forbear, the Greek word translated forbear, means to endure or tolerate. The English word means to restrain yourself. That whole spectrum of meaning is helpful for us. Forbearing one another and forgiving one another. And of course, it's not really forgiveness unless you've been wronged, right? So that would be the perfect time for us to forgive. So if the situation is unfair, forgiveness is called for. If the accusation is unjust, forgiveness would be a good response. If my partner is unfeeling, forgiveness would be perfect. We can't out-forgive Christ. He calls us to forgive. And then he says, and above all these things, put on charity, which is the bond of perfectness. And this word translated charity here means to show warm regard or affection. And the English word charity refers to acts that demonstrate care and kindness. And so these meanings round out what's being called for. They both apply. Show warm regard and kindness toward each other. Now, it's interesting looking back. I thought at the time that I was acting with 100% sincerity and care, and I was convinced that my wife's concerns were unreasonable and just couldn't be understood. But now, as I look back with more experience and perspective, I just stand in awe at my wife, how she was ever able to put up with me over that time. And that's the interesting perspective of the matter. God opens our eyes so that we can see things, but we won't get there unless we're willing to show forbearance and forgiveness and charity in the situation. And one of the challenges that we often run into, and I think God specifically made it that way because it's so good for us, but he made men and women different. Women want to spend time discussing the relationship and building closeness and openness in the relationship. And if they have something to figure out, they want to discuss it so that we can all figure it out together out loud. And men typically want to spend their time accomplishing things. They just want to put their heads down and get stuff done and mark it off the list. And if something goes wrong or if they're not sure what the next step is, they don't want to talk about it. They want to figure it out in silence. And then once they have it figured out, they want to tell people what they figured out. Well, these differences create problems. They can create an imbalance. They can create tension and conflict. But they don't have to. Because if we have warm regard toward each other, if we have kindness toward each other, then these opportunities are ways for both of us to grow. And it's good for men to stop and have to talk through what they're thinking. And it's good for us to have to share a little bit of empathy and do some listening. Those are good things. And God has designed marriage in that way for our benefit if we will only embrace it. You cannot have a good marriage. You cannot have a good friendship. You cannot have a good relationship of any kind unless you're willing to show kindness and love, empathy, forbearance, and forgiveness. And so often, as God opens our eyes, we look back and we realize, I was the person who needed to be forgiven. I was the person who needed the forbearance and the compassion and the love. And it's good for us to realize that. Now, a third subpoint here in investing in love, and that is that love requires investment. Love requires investment. You notice in our text here, Paul urges us to put off anxiety and embrace the peace of God. He says, cultivate gratitude. He says, let the word of God dwell in you richly. He commands us to teach and instruct and encourage each other. And so investment is required for love to thrive. And too often, these things are not on our radar when it comes to building relationships, building friendships, building families. Too often, we think about love as being served or being loved instead of investing in others. And so, men, if you want to experience love in a deeper, fuller way than you've ever experienced it, then invest. Step up in leading out in family worship. Step up in opening time to talk through anxieties and problems. Step up in leading your family in demonstrating gratitude and giving them daily encouragement. Invest in the relationship. And women, your support and your encouragement are powerful tools. And if you can use them and develop them and invest them in your families, as you learn to embrace the peace of God, as you learn to teach your children to rest in God's good providence, it changes the dynamic of your home. And as you demonstrate gratitude and as you learn the power of praise, you and your family can be blessed. If we invest in these things with each other, the dividends are huge. Our relationships are strengthened. We're encouraged to live love better out in shoe leather. And it happens in every relationship. And I don't know why. I have no idea why we think that if we would criticize the other person, that would really help them improve. Because it doesn't work that way. If we encourage and support the other person, that's the most likely way to help them improve. But it requires investment and example and demonstration on our part. And I think even friends know that relationships die without investment. One of the things I so admire about my wife is her willingness to give words of encouragement and gratitude. She's an expert at that, and so often she puts me to shame. But it really does give a sense of life and depth to our relationship, and I think it's true in every relationship. As we give and invest, our relationships can grow. I came across the account of a couple in New Zealand in 2011, and they were just 72 hours before their wedding. They were all gearing up for it, and an earthquake hit. Now, that's quite an event to happen right before your marriage. The groom, his name was Chris Greenslade, and he was at his home that morning. And his bride-to-be, her name was Emma, sent him a text message. And the text message said, "It's Emma here. I'm okay, and I love you very much." Now, if you're not used to relationships, maybe that doesn't mean anything to you. But if you are, you think about that for a moment, you realize there's something going on when you get a text message like that. Well, Chris understood. He raced across town to see what was going on with his girlfriend. And when he arrived there, he found out the whole building had collapsed. It was just a pile of rubble. And so he called in rescue workers and said, "Look, we've got a collapsed building. There's people in here. You need to come rescue." And so they came and tried to dig out the people that had been in the collapsed building, and Emma was definitely one of them. It took 6 hours of digging, and the whole time he's sending text messages to her, and she's responding with text messages to him. They finally managed to release her, and they were able to get married just a few days later. But it's interesting that he said he was just focused on trying to keep his girlfriend calm and trying to communicate to her how much he loved her. Now, those are, of course, very desperate times, and desperate times sort of bring those things out in us. But I would like to say, don't wait for the tragedy to happen. You have no guarantee that you have tomorrow. Invest and recognize how important it is that you communicate to your partner how much they are loved and appreciated and how much you care about them. Now, this brings us to our third point of the message this morning, and that's the rejuvenation of roses. Now, my wife and I both love roses. If there's a rose garden nearby, we'll probably visit it. And when the roses are in bloom around our house, my wife often mentions what's blooming, or if there's a particular blossom she thinks I might enjoy checking out, and so I'll come out and look at a rose, or as we go and we come, we notice what's blooming. So many different colors, so many different varieties, so many different petal patterns, so many different fragrances. They're amazing. It's a little sample of God's creativity and a testament to the handiwork of God. But how many rosebuds do you think in the world go completely unnoticed? How many blossoms bloom and die without anyone actually appreciating them? And how many people, this is the real question, how many people hurry directly past the blooming flowers or the rose gardens and they're completely focused on something else and they tell themselves, there's no beauty in the world, there's no God? Well, I don't know particularly how you feel about roses. Perhaps roses isn't of any interest to you, but there are glimpses of beauty around you somewhere. Maybe it's the sunrise, maybe it's the stars, maybe it's the wind in the trees, maybe it's just quiet conversation or a picnic somewhere, a nature walk, or reading a good story, or singing together. There are good gifts, and God gives us those things to remind us of his goodness and to allow us to build an appreciation for him and a connection with him. We are surrounded by beauty and blessing, whether we recognize it or not. But our tendency is to rush through our lives, to be driven completely by our fears and our responsibilities, and to ignore our blessings until our zest for life and our interest in relationships and our love for God and others begins to fade. And if you want a lifeless marriage or a dating relationship that's going to fall apart or a dead friendship, then just keep your head down. Ignore the blessings and gifts that God gives you. Allow yourself only to be motivated by your fears, and eventually the most ardent love relationship will die. But if you recognize the blessings of God, if you recognize his invitation to you to reinvigorate that spark, you can fan those things again into open flame. And the call to us is to put away our busyness, put away our self-seeking, put away our time-wasting distractions, and take the initiative to look for and enjoy together the blessings and goodness that God has given us. And we need to be intentional about that. And as men, sometimes we have our to-do lists and our priority lists, and somewhere way at the bottom is time with our wives or time for our families, because it's not nearly as important as all of these other things. But that's not true. I am an advocate of adding to your calendar important things for your marriage and your family, just like you add to your calendar other responsibilities, because it's important. We need to reestablish and reaffirm that connection to the goodness and blessing that God has given to us. And it's not just in marriage relationships. It's in any relationship. As we tie them to the blessing and beauty that God has given us, we find peace and grounding and connection with God and with each other. Now, there's so much more that could be said this morning, but I want to conclude with a little story and with a poem. The story is about a Russian Jew by the name of Jacob Brodsky, and his father owned a bookstore. The father wanted his son to go to college and be better off than he was and to start a career, but Jacob didn't want to. He just wanted to marry Lilla, and he wanted to settle down, and he wanted to just run the bookstore. Well, Lilla was a girl who lived in the local area, but she was a French girl, and she was very lively and very ambitious, and Jacob was very thoughtful and very shy. Well, only a few months after Jacob went off to college, his father actually became very sick and died, and so Jacob returned home, and he buried his father, and he married his girlfriend, and they moved into the apartment above the bookstore, and they settled in. And Jacob was sort of fulfilling his dream. It was the bookstore he had always wanted. He loved it. And he just settled into selling books and running the store. But his wife was dissatisfied. It wasn't really the life she wanted. She loved Jacob, but it wasn't very exciting, and there wasn't a whole lot going on. And one day she met a traveling agent who said, "Oh, you have a beautiful singing voice. If you join our tour, we'll take you around Europe and you can be famous and you can have exciting adventures." And so she came back and told her husband, I'm planning to go on tour. It's just, I'm just tired of living here in the little bookshop." Well, Jacob was, of course, devastated. And when they parted ways, he took out the extra key to the bookstore shop and said, "You take the key. Someday you're going to come back. That's the key for you. And I'll be waiting for you." So she left. And she went away. And for 15 years, she was gone. And of course, Jacob was devastated. That was the only relationship he really cared about. And so he just buried himself in his books. He didn't really speak to anybody. You could see him right there at the back of the bookshop, just reading books, stacking books, organizing books, just immersed in books. Well, after 15 years, at Christmas time, Lilla finally decided enough is enough. She was not finding the fulfillment she was looking for. Her life was empty. She wanted to go back home with her husband. And so she comes to the bookshop, and she comes in the door, and Jacob stands up to greet her, but he doesn't recognize her. And he just takes her for an ordinary customer, and he says, "How can I help you? Would you like a book?" And she was very startled, because she'd been traveling this whole way back thinking, "I'm going back home. I'm done with this life. I'm going back home. I'm going to meet my husband, Jacob." And so she was very startled. And after thinking about it for a moment, she sort of got a hold of herself. And she said, "Well," she said, "I do want a book, but I've forgotten the name of the book." She said, "It's a book about two young people who really, really loved each other, and then they were married, and they moved into an apartment above a bookstore, but the young woman was not content with her life. She wanted more, so she made some bad decisions, and she went out looking for excitement and fame. She pursued this career with the acting group for a long time, and she enjoyed a lot of success, but she felt lonely and empty the whole time. But her husband had given her a key and said, 'You come back, and when you come back, this key is yours, and I'll be here waiting for you.'" And she thought, he's going to wake up. He's going to recognize what's going on. But his face was just blank, didn't show any recognition at all. And gradually she realized, he's not going to wake up. He doesn't have any sense. He doesn't even remember this. In the waiting and in the grieving and in the self-absorption, he'd completely lost his way. "You remember it," then she said. You have to remember it. It's the story of Lilla and Jacob." He stood there with a puzzled expression on his face for a long time, and then after a lengthy pause, he said, "There is something familiar about the story. I think I must have read it somewhere. Maybe it's something by Tolstoy." And then she just dropped the key and ran off, because she just couldn't have it that he didn't recognize her at all. What's the point of a story like this? It's a shocking story. What's the point of the story? Well, love that is neglected dies, and someday it's too late to recover it. This doesn't have to be in walking away from a marriage. This can happen in a marriage that stays together day after day. It can die, and it's sad, and it can be heartbreaking, and it has effects not only on the marriage partners, but on others as well. That is not what God intends. God's call for us is to renew our relationship with Him, renew our grounding with Him, and listen to the good instruction of Scripture to build our marriages into things that honor and glorify Him before it's too late. Now the poem. And you'll recognize some of this, but I was fascinated by it because there were some parts of it that I had not heard before. There is beauty all around when there's love at home. There is joy in every sound when there's love at home. Peace and plenty here abide, smiling sweet on every side. Time doth softly, sweetly glide when there's love at home. In the cottage there is joy when there's love at home. Hate and envy ne'er annoy when there's love at home. Roses bloom beneath our feet. All the earth's a garden sweet, making life a bliss complete when there's love at home. Love becomes a way of life when there's love at home. Sweet, insistent end to strife when there's love at home. Glad submission, each one's gift. Willing pledge to love and lift. Healing balm for every rift when there's love at home. Anger cools and pressure cease when there's love at home. Children learn to live in peace when there's love at home. Courage to reach out in grace, meet a stranger face to face, find a reconciling place when there's love at home. There's no question you can't ask when there's love at home. There is strength for any task when there's love at home. Sharing joy in work or play, confidence to face the day, knowing love will find a way when there's love at home. Kindly heaven smiles above when there's love at home. All the world is filled with love when there's love at home. Sweeter sings the brooklet by, brighter beams the azure sky. Oh, there's one who smiles on high when there's love at home. Love at home, yes, love at home. Love at home, oh, love at home. Oh, there's one who smiles on high when there's love at home. And that's certainly God's desire for each one of us. Let's kneel together for prayer.